Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
So if you want to talk about an economic cliff averted, let's talk about the longshoremen who reached a last-minute labor deal last Friday, avoiding a strike that would have shut down much of the East and Gulf Coast ports, would have affected the New York, New Jersey area a lot. But let's also talk about the larger context of labor unions' decline in America. Is it doomed to continue in 2013? With us, Sue Sherman, Dean of the Rutgers School of Management and Labor Relations. Professor Sherman, Happy New Year. Welcome back to WNYC.
Happy New Year to you, Brian.
So first the longshoremen, then the big picture. The strike didn't happen. Can you explain very briefly what they needed to do to settle this strike, and if it says anything larger about labor today?
Well, my understanding is it's simply they've done another 30-day extension, so there's not a contract yet. So we haven't totally, the strike is not totally out of the question. Though, from what I can learn, they say there's been a framework agreement on the biggest issue, which are these they're called container royalty payments. But there's not much information available on what that agreement looks like. So I think we're not out of the woods on the possibility of a strike yet in Longshore.
So about royalties that they receive on containers that they hoist on and off ships. And the Longshoremen Union has about 15,000 members, which is way down from the days of, say, on the waterfront. But it's still considered an example of old-style, powerful unionism with lots of leverage. Longshoremen can earn up to $100,000 a year. They negotiated, at least for the moment, successfully here. So for all the talk about the death of unions in the United States, does this story prove that there are at least some exceptions that can be built on for the future?
Well, I think the longshoremen and women, there are now women working in longshore, though not many. Mm-hmm. They are the perfect example of what we teach in labor relations and collective bargaining about the concept of leverage. They are a small union, but the jobs that they do are both highly skilled and critical to just about everybody in the United States. All of us are dependent on the work that they do. It's very dangerous work. It's high-skilled work, and so not unlike, let's say, airline pilots or other workers in critical occupations that the entire economy depends on, these folks have a lot of old-style power to bargain, and they're using it.
Of course, other big stories of the year pertaining to unions came from Wisconsin and Michigan. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, who banned collective bargaining for public employees, survived the recall. Michigan took up the so-called right-to-work legislation, which banned mandatory union fees when that got through and was signed by their Governor Rick Snyder. Do you think that with the only 7% private unionization rate in America, it's 37% still in the public sector, that this right-to-work legislation in Michigan, of all places, sounds almost the death knell, as if 7% wasn't close to a death knell itself, of private sector labor organizing in America?
Well, I think, you know, that what happened in Michigan, what happened in Wisconsin are the perfect example of the point that I just made about leverage. I think, unfortunately, a lot of American unions have to relearn the concept of leverage and when you have it and when you don't. Clearly, in Michigan, the unions that decided to put a constitutional amendment guaranteeing collective bargaining in the Constitution completely overestimated their leverage, and they lost quite badly. In Ohio, on the other hand, when a measure was put on the ballot just to do away with collective bargaining for workers, the voters voted against that amendment to retain collective bargaining. So one of the things we do in my business, to those of us who teach labor relations to both management and labor, both parties have to really come back to the basic concept of leverage. And that, you know, the purpose of labor relations and collective bargaining is to have a fair deal for both parties. That system has gotten totally out of whack in the United States, Brian, because we're down to 7% of union density. That means that essentially the balance of power belongs to the employer.
Right. In fact, we, our data news team, put together a graphic for another segment last fall that we have up on our site now that shows the decline in the number of labor work stoppages in the United States over the last several decades. And it is so precipitous how fewer strikes there are now than there were just a few decades ago, which I guess shows that decline in leverage. But I was speaking the other day to a private sector labor union official, and I'm going to protect his identity, but his union represents mostly low-skill service workers, just those who you would think don't have much leverage. And to my amazement, he was somewhat optimistic about the future, despite their difficulty organizing these workers. He travels around the country, and he says service workers are angry, and they're organizing without unions around specific issues in specific workplaces. And I wonder if you see any new means of effective organization without unions as we know them.
Well, you know, you've just given the speech, Brian, that I give to most union audiences today. Unions, as we know them, developed in the 20th century in a primarily domestic economy. And their job was to make sure that workers benefited from the success of capitalism. That's the U.S. labor way.
Mm-hmm.
In the context of globalization, when work can easily move elsewhere to find lower wages, then you have to rethink the whole balance of power. And if you think of yourself, if you define your job as exclusively bringing collective bargaining to workers, then you're going to fail in the long run, because so many workers in the United States are either excluded from the right to form unions under labor law or to join them. So there's an entire movement of what we call excluded workers.
So in our last 30 seconds.
So your New York taxi drivers are the great example.
Uh-huh. How?
Where they're independent contractors, they've organized and they've found means other than collective bargaining to begin to give themselves some basic rights. That's where unions have to start thinking.
So maybe that's the avant-garde in the labor movement, is for us to stop
Absolutely.
Having...
Absolutely. If you look and see where the most interesting examples are, not just here in the U.S., but around the world, you see that domestic workers internationally have gotten themselves added to the International Labor Organization's code and are beginning to have legal rights which they've never had in most countries in the world for things like a restricted work week.
A conversation definitely to be continued this year. Sue Sherman, Dean of the Rutgers School of Management and Labor Relations, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Brian.